You know, the first two chords, you're right. They do sound a little bit like Beethoven. Yeah. And it doesn't prepare you for what goes on suddenly, this explosion of chaos.
That.
Yeah, and it's kind of, you think, what's going on here?
Welcome to another episode of our wonderful podcast. This time we are talking about contemporary music.
We are
Alan Gilbert
and Michael Pavlitz, and this is About Music.
And life.
The composer Arnold Schönberg is supposed to have said, if it's art, it's not for all, and if it's for all, it's not art. Is that true? Let's find out with Adam. Let's push boundaries.
So, I think we can start. Yeah, I brought some music on the phone here.
Oh, I thought you weren't going to prepare.
This is
that's okay. Are we starting? You know? Are we going now?
We're going.
Because I want to know if this is on, because I want this to be on. I mean, that okay. We're talking so about the thing, because I like self-referential activities.
Yeah. I agree totally. We agreed not to prepare and to improvise, but your concert yesterday was amazing, and I think we should have some examples here.
Well, I wanted to ask you what you thought of the concert. Just generally, the idea of focusing, for those of you who have no idea what we're talking about, I'm in the middle of a Visions Festival, that's what we call it, and it is actually the first time we're doing this festival that celebrates contemporary music and hopefully paints a picture or takes a snapshot, if you will, of what is going on in the world of contemporary composition.
That's what I really loved about it, because I didn't know the pieces. I never heard them before.
That's the idea. Yeah,
and that was
the
idea. I love that, to be in a situation, I don't know what's going to happen. I see this big orchestra, the great Elbphilharmonie, this building itself is so impressive, and you wait, what is going to happen now, the next second? And that was fantastic.
Well, that's exactly the idea. If you're walking through, for example, the Venice Biennale or Art Basel or whatever, you don't know what the next pavilion is going to hold. And that's kind of the thought. And it's quite a wide variety. And
but
so,
those artists are not unknown. I mean, Anna Torvaldsdottir, I knew her work before, and I was so excited to see her on the program. She's a composer from Iceland.
Yeah, she's an Icelandic composer, and she's very interested in, I think, nature, but also spirituality and kind of the meaning of life and where people fit into the big picture. And it's very slow music.
Maybe we have a just quick listen to a little part I recorded.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Here it is. Difficult to find a.
I mean, it doesn't really do justice to the experience of hearing the work in the hall. Yeah. But what I just thought of when I was hearing this little excerpt that you played, even on your measly iPhone speaker, is that although it's about nature and it's a common thread. I've done other Scandinavian composers, and many of them, like Sibelius even, have these kind of passages of music that remind you of an open field or a landscape or something. But it also feels very urban to me. Mm-hmm. It's kind of sounds from modern times. You feel that you're kind of, you could be in a city or like by a highway hearing cars go by or something. And so it's ultimately, even though it doesn't necessarily look that way on the page or you don't first think that, it becomes a very human experience. And I felt that that's what the audience responded to yesterday. Somehow it becomes kind of strangely moving. And if music, even unusual new type music, can do that, that's kind of the point, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think it's not what people expect contemporary music to be. Because in a way, there's this cliche of music you're not able to listen to, music you can't connect to. And I thought of Stockhausen, for example. the German famous composer who made this electronic music, who was a visionary. I remember first time listening to his music, and it was impossible for me. And I think he might be the nightmare of a Beethoven bourgeois usual concert goer.
I think, obviously, I understand what you're saying, and there's undoubtedly a lot of truth in that. But I prefer to approach things not underestimating the capacity of our audience to go outside of their comfort zone. I think people may sometimes think that they only want to hear Beethoven and Tchaikovsky, but often if they are presented with the right music in the right way, they can be open to it. Unfortunately, there's some people who are not as adventurous, mm-hmm. and these same people might go into a gallery and walk through and see different things and be interested. Oh, I never thought I would like something like that, or they end up standing in front of an abstract sculpture or whatever. I like to think of a concert as that kind of same experience of walking through a gallery. Mm-hmm. You don't quite know what you're going to see, and some things might take you and affect you in ways that maybe are even unexpected.
But you can keep a distance to art, to visual art in a way. Music,
You can also keep walking. You can go into the next room.
Yeah, exactly. You can't escape unless you really leave a concert room, concert hall. I brought because I think maybe there's the other side of the composers. Did they always compose to really get into contact with an audience, or was it anti-bourgeois composing too, especially in the 60s and
well, I mean, all through history, there have been different functions for music. I mean, it wasn't really thought of as entertainment at first, I'm quite sure. And if you go back to early church music, it was really to glorify God. Yeah. And the idea wasn't to make people escape and enjoy. But obviously, the more beautiful the music, the farther into the spiritual realm the people thought they would get. So that was the encouragement for composers to develop their craft. I think what you're referring to in the 60s is in the 20th century, there was definitely, call it a detour in contemporary music, in which I think composers actually tried to write music that was unapproachable. Yeah. And, the kind of the harsher, the more dissonant, the more unpleasant the sounds, somehow the better. There's still music that is difficult to listen to. But that, call it trend, I think has sort of, the pendulum has swung back. Yeah. And now it's not unfashionable to write music that is, consonant and beautiful.
I would love to, sorry with my music examples here, but
I love crutches, don't you? You can't.
But it's great to listen to it.
No, I want to talk to you though, but it's okay. I'll listen to me. I like music.
Yeah, yeah, you like it? Okay. Yeah. Go ahead. Some Stockhausen.
I love Stockhausen.
Beethoven Destroying the first two chords. I think they sound like a bit like Beethoven, but then.
That's cool because, the first two chords, you're right, they do sound a little bit like Beethoven. Yeah. And it doesn't prepare you for what goes on suddenly, this explosion of mad
really like
chaos.
That.
Yeah,
it's
kind of, you think, what's going on here? But that's also a little bit like life. And I think, there can be a theater a play that is highly disturbing. There can be movies that are hard to watch because the subject matter is just too painful and uncomfortable, and you cringe because you see someone getting hurt or abused or whatever, and people can deal with that somehow because this is about life and
people,
life is art.
People were
but
fighting.
It's the
fighting
same. I think it should be the same with music. It doesn't always have to be like being getting a nice back rub. Sometimes you need to be put out of your comfort zone. That can teach you something about yourself.
Yeah.
For me, it's very much about the juxtaposition of pieces, how you combine pieces. Because, I'm actually, I've been quoted, and I'm even on record as saying, I don't like all new music concerts. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is that there have been performers and orchestras and groups that realize that they have some sort of duty to present new music, and they try to take care of it all in one fell swoop. Mm-hmm. So like, okay, well, yeah, we'll do our contemporary music concert. And
usually
then
the concert starts. This reminds me of my mother telling me I have to earn my dessert. So it starts with modern music, and you get the Mozart Symphony after. I think you call it bolero.
The bolero effect, because, you know, as if somehow you can, like, make people swallow the bitter pill as long as they get bolero at the end of the concert, or some such bonbon. Yeah. It can work. It can work very well. And bolero actually is a minimalist piece.
Yeah.
And if you combine that with a minimalist composer, then you can point out that actually minimalism is not just difficult music that's just only
speaking
repetitive.
Speaking of minimalism, this story really struck me. It 2016, Cologne, it was a subscription concert of the Köln Philharmonie. There was a harpsichordist.
I've heard that. Yeah.
And he played minimal music, Steve Reich, piano phase, about 50 years old. Mm-hmm. And they were hissing him down the stage, the audience. They destroyed the concert, and he had to stop. He didn't finish the concert.
That's sad for an audience to feel they have the right to be so disrespectful. Yeah.
The Philharmonie apologized, and they gave him another concert and so on. Okay, but this moment, I wouldn't expect it in 2016.
If people are uncomfortable, then maybe that also should be a teaching moment. They should learn something about themselves. If it makes them that uncomfortable that they resort to essentially socially unacceptable behavior. You know, these people, I'm sure that they're very polite and friendly in their daily lives. And if someone prepares something, you do give them the courtesy of at least hearing them out. I think it shows something about the power of work
of music.
To actually allow people to essentially become not fully human. I mean, I'm being very strong. I don't know about this event, but I was just talking to someone, this is a slightly different subject, about the propriety of booing in concerts. And somehow it's okay. I don't know what I feel about that. I think on the one hand, it's nice when people really show what they feel.
Yeah.
But like, what happens if a singer puts him or herself on the line in an opera and does his or her best? And maybe doesn't have a great night because the singers are subject to their, the whims and vagaries of their bodies, and they get booed.
But
and
as
they
you get say, booed as you say, as
is
you
that
say,
okay?
Yeah, maybe it's better than an audience which is not involved at all.
It's true. A kind of like a response is better than kind of indifference in a way. But also, people forget that it's difficult to get up on stage and risk.
Yeah.
Revealing yourself and being vulnerable. I think it can be really cruel actually when people get booed actually.
Yeah.
It happens and it's considered, oh, that's the clock, that's the way opera audiences are. It's kind of exciting, and there's a kind of, if you see it happening to somebody else, there's this kind of Schadenfreude that you might think, oh, that's pretty exciting. But on the other hand, if you put yourself in the shoes of that person who's the subject, that's horrible.
Why do we mostly have in the concert programs music of dead composers?
Well, there's a lot of music by dead composers that's totally worth playing.
But is it because we got used to the music? We hear it so often. If you would listen to Torvalds Dottir every week or 10 times in the radio, 10 times per week, we would get used to it and it would be more normal to listen to it?
Probably. It happens with Anna's music, Torvalds Dottir. I don't think it translates so well to recording. It might, but there's a kind of physical experience that you get from actually being in the room with it. Actually, at the end of the day, all music, I think, is better live if it comes down to it.
Yeah.
But last week, the first concert that we did on the festival was by another wonderful composer, Lisa Streich.
I have an audio example. I won't play it. I won't play it.
Yeah, do, because this will make my point, because hopefully it will help me make my point, which is that that's music that I think you really miss out on some of the essential parts, the features of the work, if you don't hear it live in the physical space. It's very
Dance of
strong.
The Night, Prokofiev.
It's very much Prokofiev, and you can hear kind of Shostakovich, and but in a way it's a good, it was a good part of the piece I conducted, but it's not the most representative example you could have chosen. The thing that Lisa does is she specifies the physical setup of the orchestra, the way she wants the players to sit on the stage. And then there's actually moments where they're dynamic waves. I'll see if I can describe this for our listeners, watchers. They're dynamic waves that literally wash across the orchestra. So it's as if you hear a particle of sound or a kind of dynamic level move across the stage. So something will happen over on my right, and literally you can actually hear the sound kind of moving around the stage. And even when she doesn't do that specific effect that actually asks for the conductor to do a specific gesture to point to where the sound should be coming from at a given moment, there are other places where a certain sound will first happen here and then happen here. To a degree, we have surround sounds, stereophonic, you know, two channels, four channels, all that. But you'll never even come close to actually being in the room and seeing it and hearing it and feeling it.
Notation. Every composition or composer has an own language, I guess. How do you discover?
It can be difficult. It can be difficult. Notation is the method by which a composer puts down on paper or on the iPad screen these days what the performer is supposed to do.
Can you see if someone composed with a computer or by hand?
Well, not exactly. There are certain notation programs that people use to create scores. There are a couple, you know, Sibelius is called one, Finale is another. And there are certain quirks of the programs that, you know, default settings.
Yeah.
Most of those programs can be customized.
Yeah.
And the composer can tweak how notes are spaced or where, what font is used, and you know, the really skillful ones who know how to use the programs to the, you know, to their full potential can really control all the elements. But many composers leave the default settings, and there's certain quirks of each one. You can say, oh, okay, I can see how that mean, I've seen, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of scores, and so you start to recognize, and there are things that you can do, like take a passage and transpose it and put it in, and you can say, oh, okay, they just save time by like taking those five measures and making them these five measures in a slightly different
key. So it's a copy and paste thing, then.
Totally. Yeah. You know, the good composers obviously don't do that because they're really, they take responsibility for every note they put down on the page. But notation is a very interesting subject because it's necessarily limited. You can't write down everything that has to happen. Yeah. I give you a very stupid, sort of rudimentary example. You know, Beethoven writes forte, and then maybe four measures later, a mezzo forte or a piano or whatever. Does that mean that every single note between the first dynamic indication and the next one should be exactly the same level? Obviously not. You know, Beethoven also said, oh, well, the metronome marking is really important, but of course it only applies to the first bar, the first measure.
Okay.
And so he expected a kind of flexibility and interpretation, if you will. And so it's a tricky thing. At what point do you actually start going against what the composer intended? So that's, well, I mean, that's, you know, it's, I wrestle with that all the time. Mm-hmm. That's exactly the point.
So Lisa Streich, was she during the rehearsals? Did you talk a lot to her?
Sure. And she, like Anna, is very determined to have what she imagines in her head.
Yeah.
But at some point there's, you know, something that is referred to in the literary world as the death of the author. Mm-hmm. You know, if somebody reads a book and gets something powerful out of it, mm-hmm. that may not have been in the mind of the author.
Yeah.
Is it valid?
Yeah.
You know, at some point the author has to just like go and say, okay, my work stands on its own and you have to, you can interpret it. And can the author say, no, that's wrong. That is not the impression I wanted to give. That obviously ridiculous. And some, and in a kind of beautiful way, works of art can actually become bigger than what the composer or writer ever intended.
Yeah. How well do composers know their work? Are the differences?
Totally. I would say the better the composer, the better they know their own work. I mean, it's possible these days, and you know, the composers I deal with, obviously none of them do this, but it's possible to, you know, create a score that looks like a professional score mm-hmm. and actually know nothing about music, because you can use one of these programs and just start feeding notes in, and it will tell you if it's out of the range of the instrument. So it will, you know, tell you, oh, no, that's too low for this instrument, that's too high. And it, you know, you throw in rhythms and it lines them all up for you so that all the beats.
And, so you're not afraid of you don't have AI? Artificial intelligence composing?
Yeah, no, I understand what your question is. But I mean, yeah, sure. I'm sure that there are possibilities. But the thing is that I'm sure that there are now bots and things that can do a good simulation of a piece. And, you know,
By the way, ChatGPT, did you use it already?
I have not.
It's great.
No, I'm very excited to.
It's really great. You have to try it.
No, I will. And it raises many, many interesting philosophical questions.
You see, it
questions.
Doesn't know what it's doing.
Yeah.
You see that?
Yeah.
But it's astonishing.
It's amazing. It's in a way, it's kind of terrifying. It's also kind of exciting because the possibilities actually, if used in the right way, it's the same thing with any tool. I mean, you can use a knife for a positive function or a negative function, as, you know, with any tool. But it's composers who really hear what they're trying to write down, it's immediately apparent. Okay. I mean, I'm in the middle of actually of judging a composition competition, and you can pretty much tell right away whether composers actually know what they're doing. Mm. And by know what they're doing, I mean have an idea of what they want it to sound like and then write it down. And that's different from writing it down and then seeing what it sounds mm-hmm. like.
Yeah.
And that really separates the call it the real composers from the wannabes.
You know incredibly much about contemporary music. I know a bit, but how do you explain a child, for example, or a young person who never heard music like that before? How would you introduce a person in this world of music?
I think children are probably the best people to introduce this music to, because they don't come in with expectations in the same way as someone who has been conditioned over the years. I think we should all approach music in a way as children and just let it affect us the way it affects us.
But what do I do when I'm spoiled, older and spoiled by listening too much to Beethoven and Mozart?
What do you mean by
spoiled,
that?
Spoiled, my expectations are in the harmonics. I have special expectations, how things should be. I'm used to it.
That's on you.
But no, it's a common problem, isn't it?
When I sometimes speak to the audience, as I did yesterday, one of the things I try to do, I didn't maybe specifically say this yesterday, but I try to encourage audiences not to have expectations and to allow the music to wash over them as it happens. And if you think, oh, I want to hear a theme that I can hum as I leave the concert hall.
Or I know before.
If you, then you're bound to be disappointed. It's about managing expectations in a way, as many things are in life.
There's this amazing thing that people weren't used to have new music, were used to have new music. Nobody played old music, and I think until in the mid of the 19th century. And I remember Mendelssohn, he was did perform Matthäus Passion in 1829.
People didn't perform music of other composers. Yeah. It was all contemporary music. And it was a new phenomenon when people like Mendelssohn and Liszt started doing old music.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm glad they did, because it's a great thing. I'm glad we can play Beethoven and Bach and Mendelssohn and Liszt also. But I think one of our big responsibilities as performers is to create an encouraging and nurturing environment for people who are writing music today.
Because
that's what's going to keep music moving forward. So it's not only a museum.
But that means, if I'm right, that means that new composers, new compositions will be forgotten the day they are performed, because there's the next piece, there's the next composer. No. So it's an ongoing thing.
Well, some, but, you know, some pieces are played again.
Some survive, yeah.
Yeah, but look at all the, you know, if we go to the dustbins of history, how many works from Mozart's time have been forgotten and thrown away?
Yeah.
Many more than we know now.
But we do have the impression we know all of it, don't we?
No. Who has that impression? I mean, if you think of all the composers who were not Mozart, who wrote music, it happens that we are aware of probably pretty much everything Mozart wrote, because he turned out to be Mozart.
Yeah.
But think of all the, I mean, Salieri, even we know some of his music, but think of, you know, the Salieris and the lesser composers. Mm-hmm. I would say that the amount of music that has survived is probably a sliver, a very small percentage of what actually was written. And that's going to happen today. And it's sad, you know, if composers write a piece and spend a lot of time and it only gets played once.
Yeah, happens.
But that's life, you know, that's how it works. And the pieces that I'm, you know, a Darwinist in this way. I think the pieces that deserve to survive will survive.
And sometimes they're rediscovered 50 years later, or 20 years later.
I mean, Mahler wasn't played until there was a big renaissance of Mahler in the middle of the 20th century. And now, you know, people can't live without Mahler. Mm. Rightly so, but you know, it took Bernstein to bring him back. You know, it's and they're, you know, they're composers now, and people say, oh, how is it possible that we've neglected this, and it's only now that we're playing? Yeah, some things were unjustly neglected for the wrong reasons, whether the composer was a woman or a minority or whatever. I mean, then that, you know, we're trying. I think most of us are trying to do the best we can to correct these imbalances and unfairnesses. Mm. But also that is how it works. I mean, more pieces will be written than survive. But if we can create an environment for composers to feel that their work is valued and that they have a chance to be performed, you know, I think of programming a new piece, not only as something that I can do for that composer in that piece, but for composers more generally, because if they see, this orchestra, this conductor, this performer, they believe in contemporary music. Then that gives, you know, hopefully a sliver or even, a real spark of hope for people. Because I think at the end of the day, what composers are doing is the most important pursuit in music at any time.
There's a nice story from 1969. Beethoven Halle Bonn.
Okay.
Again, Stockhausen. The piece was Fresco. Was, I think, meant to be 4 or 5 hours. And during the rehearsal, they called the union if they have to play it, the orchestra members. And during the performance, musicians left the place. And then all of a sudden, the light went out of the music stands, so they couldn't finish it.
Sabotage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was 69. So things changed until today?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's, the world has changed, and I think what's considered out of bounds is much more extreme now, and things that were considered by at least some as unacceptable and unnecessary are sort of normal fare. Things always change. It's a good thing.
So there's hope.
I totally believe there's hope. I mean, the way the world is today, it's sometimes easy to become cynical and pessimistic. And unfortunately, I think there's a lot of reason to be cynical and pessimistic, but I think there is hope, and I think we can't give up, because the, you know, the sort of expression of human nature and the creation of art is one of the things that makes the world, you know, worth preserving.
Thank you, Alan.
This is fun.
I really like to watch you listen to music. Really?
It's the next level entertainment. Yeah, we'll just create a video of me listening to music.
Yeah, would be great video.